Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. My name is Rob Doster. It is Monday, December 17th. I have a good show on the way for you today. I was able to be joined by my buddy, Barstool Reeves, and we broke down everything that happened in college basketball this weekend. We overreacted to Kansas beating Villanova. We overreacted to Gonzaga losing at North Carolina. We overreacted to Kentucky maybe sort of kind of being back after their win over Utah. We talked about whether or not Rick Pitino will ever be accepted again at the University of Kentucky. And, oh, we talked about whether or not it is acceptable to poop on the concourse of a basketball arena. Before we get into that, though, I have to make the usual ask. Please rate, please review, please subscribe to this podcast. Any app that you listen to podcasts in, if you rate it, if you review it, if you download it, anything that you do to interact with this podcast in that app, it really does help. It helps us in the metrics. It helps us in the rankings. When that happens, my bosses are happy. When my bosses are happy, I'm happy. And when I'm happy, you are getting a better show. So saying nice things about me and giving me a five-star rating, you're really just helping yourself out in the long run. So I thank you for doing that. And now let's get into that conversation with Barstool Reeks. And now let me welcome back onto the podcast my buddy from Barstool Sports and the Fundamentally Sound Twitter account, RIP Fundamentally Sound Podcast, one Mr. Barstool Reeves. Reeves, what's going on, my man? How was your weekend?
It was good, man. Was back home for a wedding. One of my good, you know, longest friends, oldest friends getting married. And so while I missed some of the games live, which is always a weird thing to do this day and age, thankfully there's a million ways to catch up. The next day and rewatch games, which it was weird doing it for one of the first times in a while of like watching games without commercials and like going back and just rewatching a full game. I don't know. I don't know if I like it or not.
I love it. I absolutely love it because I can't deal with commercials.
I agree with that. I still have a problem watching a game where I already know the outcome.
I don't. I like doing it. It's just like watching tape.
Yeah. Yeah. I keep reminding myself. It's tape, not a game, and it's just weird. But yeah, man, it was a pretty big weekend. I suggest out there in the college basketball world.
See, my thing is with Synergy, the way that you can watch games on that, and this isn't like what everybody's going to have access to, but the way that you can watch games on it, where you can kind of cut out all the false motion at the start of a possession, and you could jump through. You don't have to watch free throws, and you don't have to watch. Teams getting set to take like the 30 seconds or whatever it takes to get set up to take a ball out of bounds, all that kind of stuff. Like I can knock out games in 30 minutes. And when the choice is sit here and spend like 2.5 hours of my day watching like a random game that I don't need to write anything off of and have to be in front of a TV for 30 minutes versus, you know, the next morning waking up and rolling through 5 games in 2.5 hours in a morning. Like, I'd much rather do the latter. Time is so much more efficient.
It is for those. I hated missing, like, I obviously had to miss the Gonzaga UNC game live, and I hate missing the big game because I think Twitter's a ton of fun during a big game.
Yeah, that's true. And like, with those big games, especially with the way that we have to do it, where you kind of have to react immediately, it's a lot more difficult. But when you don't have to write off a game, like, I would much rather, it's so much easier to watch it the next day. It's the same thing, like, with me in Red Zone. I can barely watch these NFL games that are like kind of on an island because
I can't remember watching a game like that before, or like I can't remember life before Red Zone.
No, there's like 15 minutes of total football in a 3.5 hour football game.
Yeah, and the Giants stink. I don't want to watch a full Giants game anymore.
Like, yeah, like it's
not fun
with the Red Zones, with the Red Zone and like the afternoon games and the afternoon tide slot. You basically get. When you're, there's like 3 or 4 games going on, like you see every single snap, every single one with 4 games going on. And in that, like in the early session, like it's just so much better. There's so much more action. And I love when they cut and they're like, oh, we have to go see what happened in Tampa Bay. And you immediately know it's either going to be an interception, a touchdown, a pick six. Someone's going to get hurt. Something crazy is about to happen. Every time you hear him say that.
A 50-yard gain or something like that, especially with like, how fantasy just keeps getting bigger and bigger, and you're sitting there, and it's, you know, you get the little, you know, I have DirecTV, so in the DirecTV red zone, you get the little box that just says update next, and it's like, you know, the Giants at Redskins logo pops up or whatever, and you're like, all right, what did Saquon do?
Yeah, the only problem with that is when I have like a big fantasy game, or I have too much money like invested in DFS, like I'm always like just constantly refreshing and constantly checking and being like, oh, yeah, they gained 8 yards. Who'd they give it to? Oh, all right, sweet. That was Ezekiel Elliott. Oh, we got to catch PPR. Boom, extra point. Like I'm that guy.
But sometimes it's delayed coming into my feed or into like, you know, like the app or whatever. So sometimes like I sit there and wait and I don't know what happens, especially if it's, I don't know, let's say like a Raiders Chargers game where I'm not following anybody, Raiders or Chargers, you know, covering the two teams on Twitter or anything like that. So I see it a little delayed. So, but yeah, I get what you're saying with that.
All right. So let's talk about basketball. No one cares about your fantasy football team. So, we have a lot to get to. I do want to talk about Gonzaga, North Carolina. We do need to talk about Kansas and Villanova. I do want to get your thoughts as a Kentucky alum on whether or not Kentucky is back. And we need to touch a little bit on the fact that mid-majors probably aren't going to get the bids that they deserve to the tournament again. But before we do all that, let's talk a little bit about Cal and Pitino and whether or not Richard Pitino is going to be invited back to the state of Kentucky and welcomed with open arms. And for people that missed it, and I'm sure Kentucky fans did not miss it, the 25-year celebration of the 1993 Kentucky team that made the Final Four happened, I believe it was at halftime of the game against Utah.
I believe so, yeah.
And Rick Pitino was the coach of that team. It was the first time that they made the Final Four after everything that happened with Eddie Sutton and the scandal. And you know, I didn't realize this until I went back and looked it up, but they were banned from playing on live television for a year. They were banned from the postseason for 2 years. It was pretty ugly. And Rick Pitino got him back to the Final Four in 1993. He was invited, but he did not show up for that game. And, I mean, I can understand why. But I'm just kind of curious your thoughts before I get into my take on the situation as an outsider. I know that you, I don't know if you call yourself a Kentucky fan anymore, but you certainly have valid Kentucky loyalties.
Right. So I didn't grow up, it's a little different. I didn't grow up in Kentucky, around Kentucky, and I wasn't a Kentucky fan growing up. The only reason I became a Kentucky fan was going there, which was, I went there 05 to 09. So really about 04, the 04 season when I decided to go there is when I kind of became a Kentucky fan. So it's a little different for me, but you know, I heard obviously when I went there, a lot of people from Kentucky who grew up, you know, diehard Kentucky fans were growing up in this era of Pitino. And I remember watching the Pitino teams because I grew up a Wake Forest fan and they simply could not beat Pitino. And it makes sense to welcome him back. Like if you think about it, and I know Pitino's legacy as a whole is tainted from everything that happened at Louisville, but that happened at Louisville. It didn't happen at Kentucky. If you look at what he did at Kentucky with bringing Kentucky back, like you said, to the Final Four in 93, you know, you had the Christian Laettner game, obviously, you know, that could have happened a year earlier. So he went Elite Eight, Final Four, back-to-back years. You know, he was the master, the builder of the program that, in all honesty, should have won three titles in a row. They won 96. They should have won in 97. They lost to Arizona in overtime and then won in 98 with Tubby as head coach. I mean, he was really the architect for those teams, which are some of the best teams in, you know, the last 30 years or so. When you look at the depth and talent on that roster, in terms of future NBA pros and everything like that. So if you can take out what he did at Louisville and just focus on his time at Kentucky, welcoming him back to Lexington, it makes sense, and it's something that should be done. I know everyone looks at like the Pitino Calipari rivalry from all those years, and it's like you said, I think you're the one that said it, where it's going to take some time to welcome him back, but there's no reason that Kentucky fans should be mad at Pitino. Like, he didn't do anything to hurt the program. Like, yeah, he left for the Boston Celtics. It's not like he left for another coaching job. And when he came back, he accepted Louisville. And let's be honest, like, everyone across the country can agree Louisville is one of the, 10 to 12 best jobs in America?
Yes, it is. And I guess what my take on it is, like, I understand why Kentucky fans are going to kind of buck at the idea of welcoming Rick Pitino back. You know, he was the guy that pulled this program out of the mud, like quite literally, like pulled them up from a 2 year postseason ban.
I mean, the SI photo of Kentucky Shane, like he came from that, and that says a lot.
Yeah, and so he builds them up from the ground up, more or less.
in year three, you know, the unforgettables happen and it gets him to the Elite Eight and the Christian Leitner shot and all that. Year four, getting to the Final Four, he wins the 96 title. He probably could have won the 97 title. You know, he sets it up for Tubby in 98. Like, I understand that, right? Then he goes to the NBA, and then he comes back to the arch rival when he comes back to college. Like, when you have a guy that is beloved, as beloved as he is, coming back and going to your rival, and then spending 16 years as the punching bag for the program that you hate. Like, I understand that, especially with everything that's happened with him in terms of like the three, we don't really need to spell out the three scandals that he has been involved with. You know, you've been, as a Kentucky fan, you have been trained to hate and love to mock Rick Pitino. And I get it, right? But he is also, like, there's a reason that this group is called the Unforgettables, because they did something that, maybe saying like reignited your love for Kentucky basketball is probably saying it a little bit too strong, and I'm sure that there are different people that have different feelings about this, but it's undeniable that what he did for that program was he made them good, made them relevant again, and made them something that Kentucky fans could actually cheer for instead of being ashamed of. And
I mean, I would even go as far as he set that program up to where it is today, because let's say he doesn't take the Kentucky job and someone else comes in and just can't get it up and running. Because let's be honest, it had to take something or someone special to take where Kentucky was, get recruits in there pretty quickly, and turn it into a, you know, Elite Eight, Final Four. Let's say Kentucky never like has the success that it did under Pitino, or even three quarters of that success. Is Kentucky even, and it's somewhat crazy to say, but is Kentucky cool enough or a relative enough name to get Calipari from Memphis right away?
I mean, eventually, right? Like, I don't think that Kentucky was always going to end up being rebuilt. Like, I don't think that it's the kind of program that was going to be dead forever.
It was just a matter of when.
It was just a matter of when. And, I mean, look at what's happened with Indiana, right? Indiana went through everything that they went through with Kelvin Sampson in, like, 2008, and they're still not back. And they've won two Big Ten titles, but they're now on their second coach because the first guy that they hired wasn't able to get it going the way that Kentucky or that Indiana fans wanted to get it going immediately. You know, Tom Crean had his three bad years, and then he never got it to the point that Rick Pitino got it. So I think that you do have a point in that. I still think that Kentucky would have been a program that was able to hire John Calipari when it wanted to hire John Calipari, because Kentucky is Kentucky, just like Indiana is Indiana. That said, it's what he was able to do to make them back into make Kentucky Kentucky again is something that I should think is commendable and should be lauded, and is something that Kentucky fans should celebrate. But I understand why it might take them a little bit of time to get to the point where they're able to actually say, okay, I'm done making fun of Rick Pitino incessantly and making 15-second jokes and making all of these, reminding him about the reasons that he ended up getting fired by Louisville. I understand why it's going to take you some time to get there, but eventually, Kentucky fans, I think that you probably should.
Yeah, and I think the fact that Calipari kind of went through it, not obviously to this degree, but with him at UMass, was last year where he got acknowledged or something hung in the rafters for him, and obviously people were kind of torn on that. I forget if it was a year ago or 2 years ago, a little different degree than, you know, Louisville and Kentucky, but at least I feel like Calipari is more open to it and can kind of, and knowing Calipari as the salesman that he is, will sell it to Kentucky fans during a press conference or whatever that, hey, I went through it. Here's what happened. Here's the deal with it. So, I think it's – here's the thing. Some Kentucky fans are just going to hold the grudge against him forever and will never welcome him back. But I think the majority realize what he did for the program and bring him back pretty easily.
Yeah, and I mean, I understand – look – we both are fans of a soccer team called Tottenham Hotspur, and Tottenham has been kind of built up into an international power by this guy named Mauricio Pochettino, and Tottenham's arch rival is Arsenal. So if Pochettino ever left, like, he's always getting linked with the clubs that everybody's heard of, like Real Madrid and Paris Saint-Germain and all these all those clubs like that. If he ever left for them and then ended up coming back and going to someone like Arsenal, I don't know if I would ever be able to get to the point. Arsenal and Tottenham are arch rivals, like as bad as Kentucky and Louisville is.
Yep.
And I don't know if I'd ever get to the point where I'd be able to not be angry about that fact, but I would also always celebrate what he was able to do for the team that I supported and the team that I rooted for. And that's kind of where I'm coming from with this, in that you don't necessarily have to love the decisions that he made and what he did for that other program. Like, he won Louisville a national title.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then he got the national title taken off of the record books because of stuff that happened within his program. Like, I totally get why Louisville fans are going to hate him for making Louisville great and then love the fact and mock him relentlessly for having that greatness get wiped away from the record books. But I also think that it is okay to celebrate and embrace the history that he brought to the program that you love.
Yeah, my thing is also, what are coaches supposed to do? Like, when he left the Celtics, again, was he supposed to say no to a top 12 coaching job in the country because he coached their arch rival? Like, they do have some allegiances, but at the same time, it's a job. You take the best job offer available to you, and that's what Louisville was. And I'll never, as a Kentucky grad and fan, I'll never yell at him about that. It's the best job he could have gotten at the time.
Yeah, I mean, I understand why fans will hate it, but I can't really hate on the guy for going out and finding a way to get himself a bigger paycheck. Riggs, let me ask you a question. Let's change gears a little bit. We got to talk a little bit about the Kentucky basketball team itself. They went out and they absolutely beat the hell out of Utah. Yeah. Are you to the point where, like, did they figure something out? What's going on there?
I just think this is kind of who Kentucky is the last couple years, right? Like, they have a couple losses early. Now, obviously, they don't typically get blown out like they did to Duke to start the season, but they have a couple losses early. It usually tends to happen early in conference play. People are down on them. They fall to, like, you know, 15 to 20 in the rankings. And then come March, they are the 3 seed that everyone's picking to make a Final Four. And that's why I think it's kind of dumb, to a degree, to make a blanket statement on Kentucky early in the year, because they're the one program year after year that seems to kind of adjust more or develop more as the season goes on. I think it was an important win in the fact that they went out and blew Utah out. Like, yeah, Utah's not great, but that's kind of the point, right? Like, it's a home game against a not great Power 5 school. Go out and just blow them out as much as possible. And that's what they did. I think you're starting to see Keldon Johnson continue to kind of be that go-to guy that, again, seems to develop every year. Last year was Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Kevin Knox kind of, you know, towards around this time of the year, maybe a month later, became the 1 and 2 option all year. I think you see that with Keldon Johnson. I still think it's going to end up being PJ Washington as the 1 and 2.
I wouldn't disagree with that. I think that for me, it was just the first time all season that Kentucky looked like Kentucky from the Bahamas, right? It was the first time they went out and just absolutely beat the shit out of the team that they're supposed to beat the shit out of.
Right.
And it's not something that we have seen them do this season. It's not it's not necessarily anything that they did schematically. It's not necessarily what the scoreline was. It's not the fact that it was Utah or Coach Kristowiak or anything like that. It's the fact that they came out against the team that and Utah even jumped on them early a little bit. And
Kentucky, it was what, like 10-2 or something like that?
Yeah, and then Kentucky came out and just absolutely blew their doors off. And it's the first time that we've seen them do that to a team that wasn't, Morgan State or whoever it was.
Right.
They beat somebody by 50. I don't remember who it was. But I think
Monmouth. They beat Monmouth.
Yes. It's the, not to get too cliche, but it's like the swagger that they played with. It's the first time all year that they actually looked like Kentucky, that they looked like a team that everybody thought was a preseason number one or number two team in the country. And I wonder just how much they've spent the last week hearing about how John Calipari's lost it, how he has to stop trying to recruit one and dones, how all these five-star guys that they have are not the same kind of five-star that Duke gets anymore, how P.J. Washington is a two-year guy, and Kentucky just has to accept the fact that he's never going to be what Zion Williamson is, how somebody like Keldon Johnson does not belong in the same conversation as the guys that go to Duke or some of the one and dones that end up going to Kansas or whatever, how losing Quade Green is going to end up killing their season because they lost the only guy that could shoot on the roster. They had to listen to all this for a week.
I thought it was opposite for Quade. That's my overreaction.
What? Is that they were better without Quade?
Yeah, I think they were better going to a shorter rotation. Like, and this is something me and my friends from Kentucky had talked about recently, of cutting back Quade's and Nick Richards' minutes and really going with that seven-man rotation and using them for, you know, foul trouble and just absolute necessity. But really, I mean, people keep looking at, yes, Quade was a good three-point shooter, but he was a negative out there this year. And he's a great guy. Like, everything I've heard about him, he's a great kid. But it's, from a basketball standpoint, he was a negative this year for this Kentucky team. So him transferring kind of makes life a little bit easier for Calipari with the rotations.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't necessarily disagree with that. But I think that the fact that this Kentucky team had spent the last week hearing everybody talk about how, like, they're not good enough and they need different five stars, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff, probably would have pissed him off a little bit. If you had, for an entire week, every single time you went on Twitter, somebody was telling you that you sucked, that would probably make you a little bit mad, right?
Yeah, and that's, I think, again, a positive, because, you know, Calipari and the staff probably continued to preach it behind closed doors of, hey, here's your bulletin board material that we always hear about, and what are you going to do about it? I mean, you know, challenging them in a way, which they need to, especially when you look at UNC and Louisville the next 2 weeks. Of, they need to kick someone's ass. And it's a good thing it happened at home, I think, but they needed to kick someone's ass.
And we'll know whether or not this is just Utah being awful or Kentucky impressing us by, not this Saturday, but next Saturday. They get North Carolina, I believe it's in Chicago, for the CBS Sports Classic on Saturday. The Saturday after that, the 29th. They are heading down to Louisville to play the Cardinals at the Yum Center. So we'll know all we need to know about Kentucky by the morning of December 30th. So let's move on.
What do they need, real quick, what do they need to do for you to say, okay, I think they're fine out of those two games?
Win one. Win one and don't get embarrassed in the loss.
Okay.
For me. You know,
I agree.
And we can switch gears and talk about this right now. I am very, very high on this North Carolina team. I think that their two losses are they lost to Texas on the one day his entire career where Kerwin Roach decided that he was Russell Westbrook, and then they lost on the road to a Michigan team that's been mowing everybody down when they had a freshman point guard trying to deal with Xavier Simpson, which is never something that is ideal. So I'm not that worried about the two losses, considering the context that they came in. And when Kobe White is playing the way that he's been playing, when Seventh Woods looks the way that he did against Gonzaga, when Cam Johnson and Luke May are both playing at an All-American level, when Nasir Little is your third best forward on the roster, that's a very, very, very good basketball team, and I think we saw that against Gonzaga, but we can get to that in a minute. My major overreaction, the Monday overreaction from that game, is that Gonzaga is not going to win a title if they can't figure out their defense.
I get that, and it's fair. My only thing is, does the addition of Killian Tilly, whenever he comes back, change your thought process about that?
See, my question is, how do you get Killian Tilly on the floor?
That's fair. I mean, he's too good not to be on the floor. That's one thing.
Because the way I look at it is this, right? Their backcourt is never going to be their strength defensively. Like, Josh Perkins is just not a great defender. Zach Norvell is fine, I guess, but he's never going to be a guy that you just kind of trust inherently as an elite defender, right? Like, the reason he's out there is not because he is Xavier Simpson. He's out there because he can go and score 20 points in the span of 5 minutes at any given moment, at any given time on a basketball court. That's why he's out there. Even Rui Hachimura, as good as he is and as athletic as he is, where he gets beaten is when you're asking him to guard on the perimeter in isolation. If you remember that Duke game, when Duke made their comeback, it's because they kept finding Rui Hachimura getting matched up with whoever he was matched up with, whether it was Zion, whether it was RJ Barrett, whether it was Cam Reddish, and they would attack that matchup. That's what they did. That's part of the reason they were able to come back in that game. So what's going to happen is, you're either going, when Killian Tilly comes back, You can't take Brandon Clark off the floor because Brandon Clark is the one reason that they are actually like there's some modicum of positivity thinking about their defense. He might be the best individual defender in all of college basketball. Can't take him off the floor. I don't think you want to take Rui off the floor because of everything else that Rui provides in terms of rebounding, in terms of the scoring that he brings, in terms of his ability in transition, in terms of just the simple athleticism. Like he gets beat off the dribble, but he's really good around the rim. He's really good at the whole verticality thing. Like he is a net positive on the floor, even if he's not necessarily an ideal matchup. But the problem is if Killian Tilly, Rui, and Brandon Clark are all out there, Rui is the guy that's going to be guarding somebody on the perimeter, and that's putting him in a worse situation. So then what do you do? Like, do you have Corey Kispert on the floor instead of Zach Norvell? I don't think that's necessarily a positive thing for Gonzaga, right? Like, you want Zach Norvell and his offense out there. So I just don't know. They basically have six starters that you have to find a way to condense into five at any given moment, and I just don't know what the ideal situation is for them.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, has Mark Few ever, he's pretty firm on just going man-to-man for the most part, right?
Yeah, he'll probably play a little bit of zone this year just because he has those three big guys that he wants to get on the floor at the same time. But
I mean, that's what I'm saying, at least then you have two decent rim protectors in from a number standpoint in Clark and Tilly. So if you put, you know, let's say you use Tilly as the sixth man, and then you can either bring him in for Kispert or one of the bigs, you know, depending on matchups and what you want to do. But let's say you go to three bigs together and you can run a 2-3 where you have Rui out on the wing and the two of them, you know, whoever you want to put it, put Tilly at the rim or Clark at the rim and the other one on the other wing. Does that help?
Yeah, I mean, maybe going zone does, but the thing about the Syracuse 2-3 zone that made it so good and the thing that made Duke zone as good as it was last year is the amount of size and length that you can put at the top. You know, when you have Trayvon Duval and Grayson Allen at the top of your zone, all of a sudden you have a lot of length and a lot of athleticism out there running around jumping at people, right? If you look at the best Syracuse zones, they have Tyus Battle and Frank Howard, who are both like 6'5 with long arms at the top of the zone. When you have Josh Perkins and Zach Norvell, there's not as much length, and it's not even close. And I think that is a little bit of the limiting factor there. So here are the numbers, right? There's only one team that's ever entered the NCAA tournament ranked outside the top 35 in KenPom's adjusted defensive efficiency metric and won a title. That was North Carolina in 2009. Only two other teams were ranked outside the top 35 and made it to the national title game. That was Butler in 2011, that weird year when they played VCU in the Final Four. And it was the Michigan team in 2013 that had Trey Burke at the point guard spot. So the thing that both North Carolina in 2009 and Michigan in 2013 had in common was that they were elite offensively. Both of them, I think Michigan entered the NCAA tournament as the number two offense, and North Carolina entered it as the best offense in college basketball. Gonzaga is currently number one offensively in KenPom's adjusted offensive efficiency metric and 63rd defensively. So they have that going for them. But I just don't think that with the way that they're currently guarding, they are going to be able to be a team that we can look at and say, okay, we can pencil them into the Final Four. If you can't get stops, like, that is a major, major concern for me. They are basically in the same spot now as Duke was last year when we were saying that there was no chance that Duke could win a title with the way that they defended.
Well, I was going to say even going to the same way with Duke, but when they won the title. Could we see Gonzaga just get unrealistic or unbelievably hot defensively for six games? Because we said the same thing about Duke that year with Okafor when they won it.
Yeah, and that made absolutely no sense. I still don't understand that turned around, because they were as big of a train wreck as Duke and Gonzaga was, and they didn't really change anything. They just like decided to start guarding.
But that's kind of is it just talent? I mean, because yes, Okafor is kind of a joke when it comes to NBA picks, but he was damn good in college. Winslow obviously was pretty good. Jones was pretty good. Like, they had all that talent. Do we just see Gonzaga's talent playing for six games?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, it just, when it comes down to it, it's a matchup thing, and I think it's an effort thing as well. And I don't want to say that Gonzaga is not giving effort on the defensive end. I do wonder that is how much a lack of depth comes into the conversation, because they're basically like, they don't really have that much of a bench without Tilly and without Geno Crandall. So maybe once they get those guys back and they don't have to play some of their best players like 35 minutes a night, maybe you can get a little bit more effort on that end of the floor. But it's certainly a red flag and something that we're going to have to monitor. I don't think there are any answers yet, and I do think that Mark Few is a good enough coach to be able to figure it out, but there are definitely adjustments that are going to have to be made. As far as North Carolina is concerned, what's your take on them, and you know, where would you rank them right now if you had to do it?
So my rankings just came out. I had them at 9. You could tell me, to me they're 8 or 9 depending what you do with Auburn. I think between 7 and 9. I still am a little hesitant with North Carolina. Like, they're definitely a good team, obviously, as I have them top 10. Their offense is as good as anyone in the country. Like you said, especially when Coby White's going, I think he's the catalyst for this team. I love Cam Johnson's game, man. My question is, what happens when he stops shooting the ball so well?
Then you bring in Nazir Little.
Right. And that's ultimately what, to me, like, in terms of just that flow of offensively, like, they got through, what, the first month where Luke May really didn't look good? I think that's fair to say. And Cam Johnson kind of carried him. Now Luke May obviously had a phenomenal game against Gonzaga. I just expect at some point Cam Johnson to not be a 50% three-point shooter.
That's probably fair.
Right. Like, that's going to happen at some point. So what happens? Like, can Nazir Little immediately step in and be that guy? And does Roy's offense let him step in and be that guy?
So my thing is, first and foremost, like, can we stop having the conversation about why Nazir Little isn't playing for North Carolina? The reason he's not playing for North Carolina, not starting and not playing 35 minutes a night, is because Cam Johnson and Luke May exist, and Roy Williams wants to play with two bigs.
He has, I was going to say, to me, it's more the fact that Garrison Brooks hasn't been a disaster.
Yeah, I mean, Roy Williams wants to have Luke May at the four and a 5 man out there with him. That's what he wants to do. That's the way that he's going to coach. That's the way that he's always played. That's the way that he always does it. He's not going to change, which means that he has two spots on his front line, and they're going to, right now, guys that are both seniors, one of whom was a National Player of the Year favorite coming into the season, another of whom is playing at an All-American level so far this season. So Nazir Little, that's what you have to compete with. He's not just beating out random guys. He has to go beat out two All-Americans to get minutes. He's not going to play the two. Right, he's not built for that. That's not the position that he plays. So he either has to convince Roy Williams that he needs to go full small ball with Luke May at the five, Cam Johnson at the four, and playing Little at the three, or he has to beat out one of those two guys. And so far, Garrison Brooks and Sterling Manley have been good enough where Roy Williams is not going to necessarily change everything that he wants to do just to get Nazir Little on the floor. And I don't necessarily think that he has to. I think Nazir Little, the way that they have it going, is just fine in terms of North Carolina reaching their ceiling. Like I said, I think both of their losses, I don't want to call them fluke or losses that they didn't deserve, but I think that they are understandable the way that they happened. And I don't think that there is a team that North Carolina doesn't match up with. There's teams that are going to be better with them than them, and there's teams that are going to be able to beat them, but there aren't teams out there that they can't match up with. If they have to go big, they can go big. If they have to go small, they go small. I think my biggest concern is they don't necessarily have a playmaker. You know?
Everyone talks about Theo Pinson.
Yes. Everyone talks about losing Joel Berry, but Joel Berry wasn't their point guard when it came to running offense last year in the half court. It was Theo Pinson. They don't have that guy. Cam Johnson is the guy that's playing the Theo Pinson role, and Cam Johnson is a shooter. He's not a creator. Kenny Williams is a spot-up shooter and defender. He's not a creator. Coby White is a bucket getter. He's not necessarily a point guard. So I don't doubt that Coby White is going to look as good as he's looked so far this year in terms of scoring. But on the nights when he's not scoring and on the nights when that fast break is not clicking, that's what I'm concerned about. Who's going to be able to create shots? And I think that's part of the reason that Luke May struggled a little bit this year is because he doesn't have someone feeding him offense. I got to go back and look at the numbers to see if this theory is actually correct. But I'm guessing that's what it is. He's not a guy that you just ask to go out there. Like, you ask Coby White to go out there and get a bucket. You don't go out there and ask Luke May to go get a bucket. He needs something created for him a little bit or something schemed for him.
The only thing I'll say about this is I try not to read too much into home wins. Like, when you're talking about two top 20 teams or whatever, in this case, UNC hosting Gonzaga, just because of how important home court advantage is in college basketball, to where I don't let it try to influence like my total outlook of what I believed about UNC heading into the game. Like it changes a little bit, but I try not to overreact way too much about it. The only weird thing is the Gonzaga is the game that they're going to hang their hat on as their quality win. Let's say they lose to Kentucky. How impressive was their non-conference really though?
Yeah, I mean, beating Gonzaga at home is going to matter because Gonzaga is going to be a top five, right. top 10 team in the net.
But then you're talking about like UCLA.
Yeah, I mean, UCLA is not very good, and losing to Texas is probably not going to look great at the end of the day. But, I mean, beating Gonzaga at home the way that they beat Gonzaga at home is going to look the same way to me as the way that Michigan beat North Carolina at home, if that makes sense. So I do think that it's not going to be as full as you would have liked, but there is going to be a marquee win, and there's going to be enough in the ACC that it probably won't matter. But again, like that's what made this win so important for them moving forward
if they
in
lose,
the long term.
If they lost to Gonzaga and Kentucky, you're talking about a team that's then what, right? Like then it becomes, well, is Roy even playing his best lineup? If they would have lost to Gonzaga and if Kentucky does beat them on Saturday, I think that ends up being the question that's asked predominantly around the game.
You mentioned UCLA. UCLA lost at home to Belmont on Saturday, the same day that Washington got smoked by Virginia Tech. Utah was embarrassed by Kentucky. USC got smoked by Oklahoma. Arizona lost at home to Baylor. And Oregon State lost at home to Texas A&M. And Cal won and improved to 3-5 on the season, needing a last-second jumper to get past 3-6 Cal Poly. I think the Pac-12 at best is what, like a 2, maybe a 3-bid league? The American looks like it's going to be a 2, maybe a 3-bid league. The Atlantic 10's a 1-bid league. The Mountain West and the WCC, if those two teams end up winning their automatic bids, are probably going to be 1-bid leagues, which means that we're going to have to find a way to get 36 at-large teams to this tournament. Do you think there is a chance that programs like Belmont or, you know, Lipscomb or Buffalo or Furman or Penn or Harvard or Yale, all these mid-major teams that are going out and getting these wins in the non-conference, is there a chance that they can actually get into the NCAA tournament as an at-large this year or no?
Maybe. I mean, to me, like, just look at the West Coast Conference. San Francisco should be in conversation for an at-large. Like, if you look at KenPom's rankings right now of conferences, the WCC is closer to the American, which is the 7th, than they are to the A-10, which is the 9th. So if you're going to pull a second bid, shouldn't you start there almost?
I mean, I guess, but who has San Francisco actually beaten this year? They beat Harvard at home, and that's the top 100. That's only the only top 150 win that they have on KenPom right now.
Right. They have the Harvard win, and then you hope Stephen F. Austin wins their conference. That neutral court win looks a little bit better. I mean, yeah, I think Buffalo, obviously this week is important for Buffalo going to Syracuse and Marquette. If they split those, I think they should be an at-large team, obviously, as assuming these teams don't implode during conference play or something weird happens. I think Buffalo should absolutely be in conversation. They also pass the eye test, right? Like, watch a Buffalo game. They look like a top, 30 team in the country?
Yeah, something like that. And
same thing goes with Penn and Harvard. Maybe not Harvard, Penn for sure. I think when I watch Penn play, that looks like a team that is one of the, 36 best teams in the country when you look at at-large bids.
I mean, I'm with you. I don't think that there's any chance that they actually get at-large bids. Until the NCAA proves that they are willing to overlook the fact that mid-major teams play in mid-major leagues and are never going to have the same number of chances to win games as teams in high-major leagues, they're always going to overvalue the teams at the back end of the high-major leagues. It's always going to happen. It's never going to go the other way. The cards are absolutely stacked against mid-major teams ever having a chance of getting an at-large. It's never going to happen. That said, Buffalo, if they can go into Marquette or go into Syracuse and get a win, they got a shot. You know, yeah. Belmont, if they can go into Purdue next Saturday and get a win, they got a shot. So we'll see what happens. But I never believe it's going to happen. And until I see it happen, I'm not going to believe that it happens.
Right. And this is the year that is set up perfectly for this to happen, just because, like you said, of those mid-tier leagues, when you look at Pac-12, American, A-10, Mountain West, Missouri Valley, they all look 1 to 3 bids tops. And it's rare that all that happens in 1 year. Who's the one major program that you think is going to be, you know, when we're looking at the bubble and everything that gets in, that everyone just goes, this team should not be in over a Belmont, a Furman, a Penn, whoever it might be?
Oh, man, that is a good question. It's going to be somebody from...
I have an idea of who I think it might be.
It's going to be someone from the ACC,
yep,
from the Big Ten, or the Big 12. It's going to be somebody that has a bunch of, like, good losses and then beat a bunch of, yep, mediocre teams. And it's going to be Purdue.
Oh, okay. I was going to go Clemson.
Clemson's a good one, too. Minnesota's going to be right there in that same conversation. Maryland's in the top 25 right now because they have two good losses. Seriously, yeah, go back and look at what they've actually done.
Right.
They haven't beaten anybody. They lost to Virginia at home by 5 and lost to Purdue on the road by 2, and it got them into the top 25.
Yeah, and Purdue, like, I don't think Purdue's that good this year.
Yeah, Purdue's another team. They have 5 losses on the year, but every single one of those losses is on the road to an NCAA tournament, or on the road or on a neutral court to an NCAA tournament team. You know,
and Notre Dame. I don't think Notre Dame's an NCAA tournament team.
Yeah, Notre Dame. That's not necessarily. So before Saturday, they had 4 losses. They were all to NCAA tournament teams, not at home. So we'll see what happens with Purdue. But yeah, they don't. We talked about it on the last podcast. It's basically just Carson Edwards and everyone else.
Yeah.
But here's my thing, and here's my, for all of the people that write about college basketball that listen to this, and all of the bracketologists that listen to this, and all the people that can kind of help moving things in the general direction, let's hype up these mid-major teams throughout the year. When we do these bubble watches, I'm going to write about the mid-major teams first. I'm going to make them be the most relevant point of conversation. I'm going to talk about them ad nauseum, because I think that the more we talk about how good these teams are and how much respect they deserve, you know, when it comes down to it, there's a certain, you have to have certain qualifications to be an at-large team, right? Like there's, you go through the whole selection committee process. You have all these things that they look for and all these things that they weigh and all these factors that go into determine who's going to end up being the teams that get into the tournament. But there's not, like, they don't seed them based on what the net rankings are going to be. There's right. human beings in that room that are going to value what each of these teams are. And there's going to be inherent biases that come with the fact that they are valuing what these resumes are. And I think if we just sit here and we talk about how much all of these teams deserve to get in and just beat our heads against it and keep beating it and keep forcing that down the throats of the people that are going to be in that room that consume content like this podcast, that consume content like the CBS Eye on College Basketball podcast, that listen to Goodman's podcast, that read your content at Barstool Sports, that listen to Sam Vecenie, that watch ESPN. If we keep pushing this fact that Lipscomb deserves it and that Buffalo deserves it and that they at the very least should be the teams that get the tiebreakers against the league's, the teams at the bottom, against the Clemsons and the Purdues of the world, then maybe that'll have some effect. And maybe we can kind of change what the bias is. You know, so I'm going to keep grinding on this fact and keep pushing it and keep pushing it and keep pushing it. I want these mid-major teams to get a chance. I'm sick of watching programs like Middle Tennessee State end up in the NIT. And you know, Murray State a couple years ago with Campaign getting sent to the NIT. It really grinds my gears, Reeves, and it gets me fired up. And I'm going to start pushing for this Campaign. And you got to back me. You got to help me out with this.
I agree.
Man.
Here's my thing is, I hate when people try too hard with the mid-majors. Right? Like, we have to talk about them fairly. And it's true, like, mid-majors are not talked about fairly on both ends. Some people take the spectrum too far and are like, no, this is actually, like, the 20th best team in the country. It's like, well, they're not, right? Like, to me, like, Furman's not one of the 25 best teams in the country, even though they're ranked. Like, when you look at their schedule and everything, they have 3 wins over non-Division I teams. That has to be talked about as much as the win at Villanova or the win at Loyola Chicago. So, to me, it's like, yes, we should push mid-majors because I do think a team like Buffalo is a real top 30 team in the country and should be an at-large. I do think a team like Penn should be talked about a little bit more and should be viewed as a possible at-large. Like a team like Furman, I think it's fair to question just how good is this team? They're undefeated, yes. They have the win over Villanova, yes. But then what else? Like, to me, like, Loyola's not good. Like, yeah, they're going to be a tournament team because I think they're the best team in the Missouri Valley. Sure, let's talk about that as a quality when it's on the road. But are we really going to hype them up for beating USC Upstate?
No. And here's the thing that people don't realize is that of their wins, they beat Villanova on the road in overtime, and they beat Loyola Chicago on the road by two. And then their other 10 wins come against non-Division I teams or teams ranked outside of the top 200 in KenPom. So it's not necessarily that. Yeah, and it's not necessarily super impressive. The double overtime game was at home against a very, very, very bad Western Carolina team, which, in their defense, was a conference game. Conference games are notoriously tough. But we get Furman plays at LSU on Friday. And next Saturday, they play at Tennessee State. And in their conference, we also have Wofford and UNC Greensboro, who are both top 100 KenPom teams, who are going to be in the conversation for, like, winning that league. You know, as good as Furman's been, I don't necessarily know if I would put them as the favorite to win that conference. I would probably put Wofford as the favorite to win that conference. So,
yeah, I even think UNC Greensboro is a little bit better than them.
They might be. I mean, UNC Greensboro put in quite a performance at Kentucky in a game that they were leading with like 7 minutes left. They lost by 17, but they were leading with 7 minutes left.
Right. And to me, that's one with the mid-majors. I absolutely agree. They need to be talked about more. But I just ask, like, people who do cover the sport and everything like that, don't take it too far. Like, let's not make this every mid-major needs to get in, because that's just simply not true. They just need to be viewed about fairly. And I think we're on the same page. That needs to be the argument more than, well, we need to punish this major program who is one of the 36 best at-large teams, but we need to get another mid-major in there just because.
Yeah, I'm with you. The last thing I'll say about this, and then we can move on, is that Furman losing at Wofford is not a bad loss. UNC Greensboro is not a bad loss. Let's not pretend that it is. All right, before we get into the last subject, which I think is going to be the best subject of the day, you got any hot takes for me on Kansas beating Villanova? Anything to take away from that other than it's two teams that just don't seem to have figured out a way to win basketball games the way they want to win basketball games?
Yeah, I get yelled at this all the time, or so far this year. I think Kansas fans hate me more than anyone else, and you're my brother in arms on this, because me and you both had them outside the top five last week, and I think we both have them five this week in our rankings.
Yeah, I have them one spot in front of Gonzaga. The top six, you can put the top six in any order, and right. I don't necessarily think that I would argue with you about it this year, even though I do think that Duke is unquestionably the best team in college basketball.
So is Villanova really good then? Because a top five team shouldn't struggle against a non-ranked team at home.
I mean, look, right? Here's my thing on Kansas. We're not going to know who they are as long as Udoka Azubuike is not healthy. Because when Udoka Azubuike is not healthy, it means that Dedrick Lawson has to play the five, which is not his best position. His best position is at the four. When he is at the five, they don't have anyone that is actually an offensive threat that can play the four. They have to play KJ Lawson there. They have to play Marcus Garrett there, and that's not necessarily what they want to do. When Quentin Grimes is playing like he's Rick Grimes from The Walking Dead, then all of a sudden you're in a situation where you basically have 2.5 offensive weapons on the floor. It's the Gerald Vick, Dedrick Lawson, Devin Dotson on the nights when he decides he wants to show up, and then nobody else. So Kansas is basically a two-man team that has their best player playing out of position and nobody to fill the role that he vacated. So until Udoka Azubuike gets back, I'm not making any kind of final determinations on what I think of Kansas, but I will put it like this. Bill Self he's got to figure it out. But the fact that he hasn't figured it out yet and Kansas still has the best, like, I think it's undeniable they have the best resume in college basketball. They're basically like they're going to be a lock for a number one seed. It's because they're going to win the Big 12.
So you might as well lock them into a one seed in the now. Big 12 if they finish like third in the Big 12 or second. What if they finish second in the Big 12?
If they finish second in the Big 12, like it's not going to happen. Let's just not even discuss that as a possibility until it happens.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's been so long. But I'm just saying, they do have the best resume in college basketball. But again, it's one of those where if you watch their games, they never looked the part since, what, the Michigan State game?
I mean, since the first – like
the last five
minutes of the Michigan State game, they were terrible.
Yeah, that's true. They're a weird team. And I agree with, you know, getting Azubuike back, but it's same thing that we kind of asked about Cam Johnson. LeGerald Vick has never been this good for this long at Kansas. Does it fall off at all? What happens if it does fall off?
I mean, it has from game to game. He has games where he scores 28 points and games where it looks like he's shaving points.
Right.
So I don't know. I'm at the same place with Kansas and that I've been all season long. I get the potential. The resume is impressive. They're still winning games, but they are nowhere near their peak. You got anything to say on Villanova?
Yeah, my hot take is they're still going to win the Big East.
The Big East stinks, man. Who's the best team in the Big East?
Low key, who I think it is?
Yes.
Creighton. That's kind of my hot Big East take is that I'm not going to be shocked if Creighton wins the Big East.
I think Creighton is a year away. I think they're still a little bit too up and down. But I like what you're doing there. I see what you're doing. I think it's going to be Marquette.
I don't disagree with that. I would not be surprised if like Creighton Marquette on what they play with March 3rd ends up being kind of whoever wins that is in the
Let me take that back. Villanova is going to win the Big 12 or the Big East.
They always do. Yeah,
I think they're going to win the Big East, but I think that the most dangerous team in the conference. Like I predicted that Marquette would be in the Final Four in my preseason predictions. I like to go off the board with one.
Yeah,
What I do every year is I pick three teams that are obvious Final Four picks, and then one that's completely off the board as a fourth Final Four team. Like last year, I picked USC to make the Final Four.
That one kind of blew up in my face.
And Marquette was my pick this year, so I think we're mostly on the same page. You're not buying in on St. John's yet?
I just don't trust them. And like that's kind of how I feel with Marquette, too, defensively. St. John's, I just don't trust in general yet. Like they're getting bailed out just because Shamori Ponce is so good against weaker competition. I want to see what they do against somebody somewhat decent. For me with Creighton, it's just I trust outside of Jay Wright, I think I trust McDermott more than any other coach in the Big East.
Yeah, probably. I think that's probably fair.
Him or, I mean, yeah, Cooley's always going to be there. And I guess I trust Laval Jordan probably third just because, or fourth just because Butler's always consistently.
Yeah, they looked really, really good in that game against Indiana. And Indiana deserves a podcast all of itself. And I'll probably get to that later in the week. But that was quite a basketball game, and Juwan Morgan is quite a basketball player. Last thing before I let you go, Riggs, Tennessee played at Memphis on Saturday. Environment was absolutely raucous. We had a little bit of a skirmish after the game. Penny against Rick Barnes, once Penny gets that thing rolling, gets those players coming back in, is going to be a terrific rivalry. That having that game is good for the sport.
Awesome.
But the highlight of that game, it wasn't Admiral Schofield scoring 29 points. It wasn't Tennessee jumping out to a 15-point first-half lead. It wasn't any of that. There was a guy, I guess at halftime of the game, that took a dump in the concourse outside of the arena. And this is apparently what he told the police officers when they showed up, when he was caught by a security guard taking a dump in the concourse. He said, I had to do what I had to do.
Yeah, because the line was taking too long in the bathroom. Like, I'll give him credit. This was not the first option. He tried option A. Option A was not possible. He could not get into the bathroom. He went to option B, which was going behind the concession stand. At least he had the decency to go behind the concession stand from what I read.
Yeah, and, you know, I feel for the guy, man. Like, who hasn't been there?
Right, like you're panicking. You might, you know, you're looking around. Maybe you're on a road trip. You're like, okay, where's the next exit? Desperate times call for desperate measures. And for our boy, what was it, Royce Ludholz, it was the concession stand.
Do you think that, like, I wonder, what did he wipe with? That's my question.
Napkins. He was at the concession stand.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Just thinking about that makes me... gives me lemon booty.
I have a lot of questions. One is, what concession stand was it by? Was it one of those like all? Was it a specific concession stand? Like, are we talking the soft pretzels, or are we talking kind of the little bit of everything? And then my second question is, it said that his pants were totally off of his body, Was he just like hanging them up over the side of the concession stand? Because that's an image all in itself.
Oh, what? I missed that. He had his pants off of his body.
So it said, I'll pull it up here. It said, so a security guard, she went over to Ludholz and found that he had his pants off his body, exposing himself to several people walking nearby and was defecating on the floor.
Okay, so maybe this just wasn't just an emergency. He had his pants off of his body?
Here's again, in fairness to him, if you're going behind a concession stand, you got to be careful, I guess, and not get any on your pants.
No, you can. No, this. There's definitely more to the story then. There's definitely more to the story. Because when was the last time you took your pants all the way off your body to take a dump, Reeks?
I mean, it's been a while. It's been a while.
You've never done that.
It's.
I have a 3-year-old and he doesn't even do that. He knows that you put your pants around your ankles and you sit on the toilet and you take your squat. And like, look, we've all been there, man. Like I'm not gonna lie. Like I've gone on runs and sometimes you get hit when you're on a run and you gotta go find a bush to go behind. Like we've all been there, right?
On the golf course, you're on the sixth hole and you're as far away from the clubhouse as possible.
When I used to work construction in summers, like the guys told me, just bring some toilet paper in your car because if you gotta go, you just gotta go. And you know when you're waking up at 7 in the morning, you're drinking 3 cups of coffee just to make it through a day. Working construction, you know, sometimes you got to do what you got to do. So, like, I've been there. I understand it. But I've never taken my pants all the way off my body to do that.
Here's my final question, and I think it's an important one. I need to know if he's a Tennessee fan or a Memphis fan.
Oh, that is a good question.
I need to know which one he is.
I don't know if we're ever going to know. I'm assuming he's a Memphis fan because it was in Memphis.
But that does – I mean, there's a lot of Tennessee fans in Memphis. That's like saying if it happened at Kentucky Louisville in Louisville that it had to be a Louisville guy. A lot of Kentucky fans in Louisville.
It sounds like he's from – yeah, I don't know. That's a very good question. I'm guessing if he was maybe the fact that he was actually arrested makes me believe that he was a Tennessee fan because if he was a Memphis fan, maybe the Memphis security guards let him walk.
He hangs some checkerboard orange pants over the concession stand to go.
That, you know what? That makes sense. That's why he wasn't able. That's why he had to take them off. Because when you have checkerboard orange and white pants on, you have to make sure that you don't get anything on them when you are taking a dump behind a concession stand.
I mean, this just lets you know that the Tennessee-Memphis rivalry is back on.
It's like, on, baby.
All,
it's on.
We all remember. I still remember to this day where I was when it was number one versus number two with Pearl and Calipari. And I remember where I was watching that game. And it's awesome for the sport that Tennessee and Memphis have this rivalry. If he's a Tennessee fan, I need a Memphis fan to retaliate when it's in Knoxville.
Where is the weirdest place that you've ever taken a dump, Reeks?
None stick out. I mean,
have you ever taken a dump at a sporting event? Period.
No. God, I will leave if I have to.
What about like at a concert? Have you ever been like in an all-day festival and had to go in one of those porta potties?
I've never done an all-day festival. I've been to a million concerts, but never the all-day thing. I mean, probably like the golf course. I think once on a golf course when I was younger, where like I didn't have enough time to get back to the clubhouse. You just go in the woods.
Yeah. I don't golf, so I wouldn't know, but I've definitely gone in the woods before.
Because like I never worked construction or like painting or any of that. You know, I didn't work an outdoor job growing up. I'm trying to think.
I feel bad for old Royce, man. That's all I'll say. Yeah, I feel bad for Royce. We've all been there. We've all had that emergency. We've all had to make that run. And, you know, he got caught.
I feel bad for the concession stand workers that saw it unfold.
Who do you think cleaned it up?
I mean, that should have been. I'll tell you what. Instead of getting arrested, they should have just let him clean it up and call it even, Steven.
I'll tell you what, man. If I was the security guard working, I would have made him pick it up himself. I would not be touching that.
And then you know what? Just call, like $100 fine and call it even, Steven. that seems fair to me. Like he, like I said, it was option B. He tried option A. That wasn't an option. He went last resort. Just let him clean it up, and then it's done.
We actually had a big thing in New Jersey about this a couple of years ago where like the superintendent of – I want to say it was like the hometown. Remember Sammy Sweetheart from the Jersey Shore?
Oh, yeah.
I want to say it was the superintendent from the guy of that town got in like a lot of trouble, ended up losing his job. He went viral. I think he ended up getting a divorce because of it, because he would go running every morning, and every morning they would just find, like some guy was pooping under the bleachers. Like it was a serial pooper under the bleachers at the high school. Like every morning he'd go running, and every morning they'd come and they would find like a pile of poop, a pile of human poop under the bleachers. And eventually, like, they had a stakeout. Like, there were cops that were paid to go on a stakeout at, like, 5 o'clock in the morning in April, and they caught this guy in the act of pooping under the bleachers.
I'll tell you what. If you have to deal with high school kids for that long, I'm assuming that something just drove him to it. God bless teachers that have to deal with kids all day.
Look, you know what? I've made a lot of mistakes in my life. I am proud to say that I've never ruined my career, ruined my life for taking a dump in a place that I shouldn't have been taking a dump. And maybe I'm just lucky and I haven't got caught doing it yet, but
right.
But that it is, look, it is what it is. You do what you have to do, Reeks. But look, I'm going to let you go. You just texted me that you have to go take a dump right now and you don't want to do it while we're live on the podcast. So I appreciate the time. If you're listening to this, you probably know where to find Reeks already. He is at Barstool Reeks. My man, I appreciate the time.
All right. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening. Follow me on Twitter.
Give me 5 stars.